This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, October 21st, the Norris Group proudly presents its 9th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event is not possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Housing Wire, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club for Women, MVT Productions, the San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, Inland Empire Real Estate Investment Club, Think Realty, and White House Catering. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information and tickets.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is John Burns. John is the CEO of John Burns Real Estate Consulting. He founded the company to help executives make informed housing industry investment decisions. The team enables the profitable development and ownership of the best places to live in the world through great research for industry executives and their investors. The team's consultants and analysts navigate their clients through housing cycles, helping them satisfy homebuyer and renter demand. John recently co-authored Big Shifts Ahead, Demographic Clarity for Businesses, which will be available for purchase October in 2016. And I have got a preview copy of that. I am very excited to say 400,000 plus people follow John's LinkedIn influential column, and 30,000 plus subscribe to his emails, and the media cited the firm 400 times and over in 2015. John, I really welcome you to our show, and thank you for taking time to be part of our October event. I really appreciate that.
My pleasure, Bruce. That's a great event.
The study of demographics is, it can't be new to you because of the business that you're in. So when you approach this subject in this book, was it your intent to add to what you already knew, or take an eraser to the chalkboard and basically start from scratch?
Both. You know, so much of the research we had done and others had done was assuming that today's 20-something would behave like their parents, and it just has not been panning out that way at all. So I was trying to figure out why. And then the other thing was that we've been just pounded with daily emails about demographic this, demographic that. It was completely overwhelming to me, and so I wanted to organize it in a way that I could make sense of it and people could use it. So that was the gist of doing this.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how important do you view demographics as a predictor of what's next?
It's a 6 or a 7, maybe. I mean, what I learned doing this is that demographics is the big long-term future, but demographics can get shifted a lot by other things. And so that's why I'm not saying demographics are a 10. You know, government policies have changed behavior massively. The economy, technology now is shifting the game. So there's a lot of things that are going on. If you wanted to call those demographics, I'd say a 10. But I think there's a lot of things impacting the world and shifting consumer behavior massively.
Just on that note, I'm spending 4 days at events I never thought I would attend, and it has to do with robotics, 3D printing, everything that's I can hardly comprehend. I'm going to try and completely understand, and the reason I'm doing that is I think, just like if you were a Blockbuster Video 10 years ago, you know, you probably didn't know you were going to get replaced with something that's on your, you know, on your phone. And so I wonder if there's going to be some very big shifts in usage of commercial space and things like that, just on the things that I see that I don't comprehend yet. One of the people that's on the panel, Sean O'Toole, you know him, I think.
Yeah.
Sean's a really bright man, and he's very much into computers, has been since he's 10 years old. He used to do startup companies in high school, if you can believe that.
Right.
Anyway, so 5 years ago, we're driving to the Nixon Library, and he's telling me, you know, about 3D printers. He bought his 10-year-old son a 3D printer, and I didn't even know what a 3D printer was. That's how, you know, far behind I felt. So anyway, yeah, there's just a lot of things that are coming that are going to be game changers. So when you think of demographics, do you think that's more accurate 10 years out or 50 years out?
Oh, it's definitely not very accurate 1 to 2 years out. I mean, we're all going to be 10. I think 10 years is probably a good rule of thumb.
And I kind of got the sense you kind of picked the time frame because of that.
Well, yeah, I picked 10. All the forecasts in the book, we went out to 2025 because a lot can happen in economic cycles and things. But I thought a nice way for people to understand this, and first of all, generations are 19 years apart. So Mark Zuckerberg and his high school kids and my daughter, who's a high school junior, are both millennials. I mean, they're not in the same spending mode and in the same stage of life. So we broke this down by the decade people were born. And so I kind of stuck with a 10-year theme here. And I thought with normal life cycles, picking the years people had their 10-year high school reunion and 20-year high school reunion and 30-year high school reunion, everybody can relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
So we used the ages 28, 38, and 48 throughout the book to compare current generations to prior ones. And the findings were pretty fascinating to me anyway.
No, they were, and it was a very interesting way to look at a topic that's sort of already locked and loaded in a way. You know, I wonder, have you had any blowback about changing the, you know, how you say what time frame is covered when you talk about the baby boomers? You know, everyone knows the baby boomer generation started in 1946 and lasts a long time. And like you said, that's right. 19 years. And now you're sort of saying, well, if you divide that in half, or you divide, you're not even actually taking the same time frame, which to me is interesting. So here's a good question. You started at the beginning of each decade as opposed to an event inside of that decade. So what was the process there?
So the process was, people relate to what year they were born in your high school classmates. And some people who are boomers don't relate to boomers. And I just wanted to keep every period simple. 10-year periods, you know, I was born in the 60s. I understand the 60s. My parents were born in the 30s. My kids were born in the 90s. And it makes it all a heck of a lot easier to do the math, too. To say that a generation is currently 36 to 45 years old today, and they're probably in this life stage, it really simplified things. I've had zero blowback at all. In fact, the exact opposite. It's just been, oh my God, this is so enlightening. I totally appreciate this. We've been discussing millennials, and everybody talks about their 25-year-old son, but nobody's really breaking it out this way in ways that make more sense. And one of the more interesting things is there's a huge chunk of millennials. Most of those born in the 1980s have already formed their households. I mean, they're out of the house. The ones in the 1990s haven't. The ones in the 1980s are renting, though. They have not become homeowners yet. So it really just clarifies the whole discussion and helped me make sense of it.
And it is a game changer because I do a lot of reading and research, and when you gave me that copy and I printed it out, I mean, the whole thing's yellow marked. I went through it very methodically because I really realized this is a much better way to look at this because of the change. One of the things you had said was that one of the generations, you know, the first 10 years, they didn't even have computers in school.
Right.
And it was an assumption, of course, you had, but things happen so fast. I've got grandkids. Well, actually, I have grandkids that have grandkids. That's how old I am. But we have a 2 or 3 year old granddaughter that walks around with her handheld device searching for the movie that she wants. And you're just going, wow, that's just, it's definitely different.
The information at these kids' fingertips has been, is amazing. And we came up with something in the book we call the 4-5-6 rule. But the four is the four big influencers: government policies, economic cycles, technology, and societal shifts. And you just hit upon some of the tech ones that have been complete game changers here. I mean, we would not have discussions about kids not having driver's licenses if it were not for Uber, and that wouldn't be around if we didn't have GPS and smartphones and all those things. And it's fascinating how this is shifting behavior.
And importance, you know, that's the thing. I guess I would just think, I want to drive myself. I mean, honestly. And then you realize that you're going to be driving here pretty soon against or next to a car, not against, hopefully, that's not got anybody in it other than a passenger. That's going to be a little bit of an unnerving experience.
Maybe unnerving for you, maybe unnerving for the computer driving next to you, because statistically he might be safer driving.
You know, Sean O'Toole actually pointed that out when I kind of tongue-in-cheek said, yeah, I can't wait till I'm driving next to one of those. He said, well, the truth is they'll do a better job than you. He said, because the computer chip that's in there is so sensitive to knowing your reaction. He said you could play rock, paper, scissor game with it, and they will win 100% of the time because it can pick up your impulse.
Yeah, and they're not driving drunk, and they're not texting while they're driving.
Right? Yeah, that's true. Well, that's a big thing right there. Of the things that you just talked about, the big influences, so technology, economy, government, and social shifts, for the next decade, do you see any one of those four playing the most dominant role?
Well, the economy always plays a big role here. And, you know, what the millennials, if you will, those born in the 80s, the first 15 years of their working lives, the economy has been crappy. So that you want to talk about why they're not spending money and why they're thrifty and why they're not becoming homeowners, the economy's played a big role. You know, with the election looming right now, immigration policy has been a huge game changer. We had more immigrants over the 20-year period in the 90s and 2000s than the prior 60 years combined. So a third of our population growth has been immigration, and clearly if the government changes that, that's going to be a massive game changer.
Well, in your book, you point out it's not somebody that's coming now is different than what we think of. Okay, we've got to stop this because this is occurring. And then you know, you put out the statistic, and what you're saying is basically what we're concerned about isn't concerning, isn't even happening. It's the people that are coming are different. So tell us about that. Who's coming now?
So immigration has two components to it. It has our willingness to let people in and people's desire to come here. And it's very clear to me that the desire from Mexico has waned dramatically, because the net migration back and forth to the United States has actually turned negative. There's been more people coming out, leaving, than coming in. But what has changed is that the super economic growth in Brazil and Russia and India and China, these BRIC countries, has created millions of upper middle class people who desire to come to the United States, and they're getting here on planes, and they're buying homes and doing all sorts of things. It's been a real game changer for immigration.
What stage of someone's life seems to have the most impact on what they do for the rest of their life?
You know, I think it's the first 10 years after, well, so the 4-5-6 rule, the five was the five stages of your life. I think maybe what happens as when you're a child maybe is probably most influential. I'm looking back to the people born in the 30s who had to go through the Great Depression and then rationing in World War II. They were thrifty savers. Think of Warren Buffett type and his high school classmates. Very thrifty and conservative, became homeowners. And you contrast that with say, somebody born in the 50s who the economy, who, you know, were very impacted by the space race in the 60s, that made them very interested in tech, We had some of the best tech companies ever created by people born in the 1950s. The economy cranks their entire lives. And they're all going to be turning 65 over the next 10 years, those born in the 1950s, and their net worth is $18 trillion right now. They're the wealthiest group of retirees ever. They're going to change the game in retirement. So I don't know if I answered your question, because I think every stage matters, but I think maybe what you see most early in life, maybe in your teens and 20s, probably impacts you the most.
You dedicated the book to your mom and dad, John and Mary Burns, and yeah. They were savers. They were born in the 30s, and they went through all those experiences that you just mentioned. As a generation as whole, how did the savers end up retiring?
Very affluent, because they saved. they also started a 200% increase in divorces. Fortunately, my parents were not part of that, but Elizabeth Taylor was part of that generation.
Okay.
They generally did very well, and they also benefited from the huge rise in pension plans and Social Security and Medicare and the government taking care of them. So they really had it pretty darn good.
Is there a group after that, one of the new generations that have kind of similar early experiences, maybe not as severe, that you think are going to follow on a similar path?
I do. I think those born in the late 80s and the early 90s were born into the Great Recession instead of the Great Depression. They've become very thrifty, very frugal. We call those born in the 1980s the sharers, because they were the architects of creating the shared economy. They use technology to do it, but they're all about, hey, I've even got one who's a married couple with a kid who rents out a room in their house to a friend. They're sharing their lives to be frugal. They'll rent prom dresses. They're not going to take on a 30-year mortgage like their parents did, because their parents took it on with the confidence that they'd have employment the rest of their life. This group knows that, hey, we could have a recession next year and I'll lose my job. So this 30-year mortgage is a pretty risky thing. So I think they're going to behave very conservatively, but they're not going to be asset accumulators like those in the 1930s. They're going to be a little bit more about living now and living frugally, if you will.
So how does that play out when they retire? Because it seems like one of the things that I've noticed, there's a huge gap between the net worth of somebody that owns a house and the one that doesn't.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think society more than ever is focused on today and now and not the future. And I don't see a lot of home buying activity amongst this younger crowd, and certainly not with the thought of, hey, I need a home when I'm 65 with no mortgage. And I'm speaking generally here. I think there are people that think that way, but as a percentage, I think their home ownership, for example, is going to be lower.
The latest group, you call them globals.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, how did you choose that name? Is that because of their they come from all over, or the mindset of the people?
So those were born in the 2000s. It's too early to tell really how they're going to shift the world, except I think their access to information, the heavy immigration the United States has seen from all over the world, they know kids from all over the world. They know what's going on around the world. I think we're morphing into being more of a global society, if you will, instead of my country versus your country, which is more like prior generations were like with the world wars and things.
When you come from a country, let's say, that home ownership isn't a big deal, you know, before it seemed like when people showed up to America, one of the reasons they showed up is that they wanted home ownership to be a big deal, American dream. And is it now that they're bringing more what they're used to, and that's okay, as opposed to I'm coming here because there's an opportunity?
I'm not sure what you're asking, Bruce, because
in other words, different people, let's say if you come from I don't know France, what percentage of people own their homes in France, but if you came and immigrated here and you brought that I don't need to own attitude, that might change a whole generation as far as percentage of who cared to participate in owning or not.
You know, I think that's true, but we're not finding that this new, more affluent immigrant is not interested in home ownership. In fact, we're finding the opposite. There are plenty of new home communities out there that are 80% from one specific country, whether it be India or China. They want to be homeowners here. It's actually the American-born younger generation that I think is holding off, which is a complete reversal from our previous discussion on immigrants of people sneaking across the border in search of economic opportunity. That's not the majority of immigrants these days.
What's interesting, too, is the timing of all this. We have an interest rate that starts with a 3, and you or I are old enough to realize that's like on sale.
Right.
And it doesn't seem to be appreciated or taken advantage of, and that's a 30-year decision.
I know, that blows my mind. And it's a one-way option, too, because if it goes to 2, you can just refi. But if it goes to 6 and you didn't buy, you missed out on a big opportunity. But again, going to this shorter-term focus now, so the fact that we have a 3.5% mortgage rate, for most couples, mortgage interest is no longer tax-deductible. Because a $200,000 mortgage at 3.5% interest rate is only $7,000 in interest, and the standard deduction is $12,000. So prior generations had a kick in the pants every April 15th. Gee, honey, we should go buy a house because it'll help us save on taxes. You never hear that discussion anymore.
Yeah, that's an interesting switch. Your book concluded that you thought that the next 10 years that homeownership would actually be down more.
I think it's going to fall below 61 by 2025. And that sounds like a really bearish projection, but we looked at every single demographic. And keep in mind that those that are currently in their 60s and 70s have north of a 75% home ownership rate. They're going to be passing away. So
right.
They're going to all a very high ownership, home ownership amongst people that are passing away. And are the people moving into the workforce going to have a 75-80% home ownership rate? Not today. Not until much later in life, and I don't even think they're going to get there later in life.
We got less than a minute. You coined a new word. I wrote it in today, and it's not – it spell checked it. So Serban doesn't exist yet. So what does Serban mean?
Yeah, we put a trademark on it just for fun. So urban – one of the government – shifts has been the government used to invest in highways out to where you could build communities, and they've been investing in urban areas, and urban areas completely revitalized. But urban is very expensive, and so the suburbs have said, hey, we want some of that urban in our community, and we're calling it Serban, bringing the best of the urban to the suburbs where it's more affordable, maybe the schools are a little bit better, closer to a job. Much more highly desirable. We think that's the wave of new development.
We're out of time for today, John. We appreciate your time and looking forward to having you on our panel.
All right, thanks, Bruce.
All right, thanks a lot.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Auction.com, Coachella Valley Real Estate Investors Association, Coldwell Banker Town and Country, Elite Auctions, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keller Williams Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA Green Designs, LA South RIA, New Western, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Investment Club, Orange County Building Industry Association, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Realty Executives Inland Empire, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Sunoco Corporation, South Orange County Real Estate Club, Spinnaker Loans, UDirect IRA Services, Weston South Coast Plaza, Wholesale Capital Corporation, Wilson Investment Properties, Inc.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.